Hello, and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Jonathan Taplin, professor at the University of Southern California Annenberg School for Communications. I'm sitting in for Ian Masters while he takes a rare and well-deserved vacation. We're going to begin and speak with Thomas Edsel, professor at the Columbia University School of Journalism, about his book, The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Remake American Politics. We're then going to talk to Trevor Potter, who was a Republican FEC commissioner from 1991 to 1995 and has represented Stephen Colbert in front of the Federal Election Commission, and we'll talk about super PACs. And then finally, we're going to end up with Dave Lowry, who is the singer, songwriter, and guitarist for the legendary alt-indie bands Cracker and Camper Van Beethoven. And we're going to talk a little bit about music sharing, file sharing, advertising, and intellectual property. Joining us now is Thomas Edsel, a professor of journalism at the Columbia University and author of the book, The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Remake American Politics, which is recently out in paperback. He has an article at the New York Times entitled, Is Rush Limbaugh's Country Gone?, which really fascinated me. Tom, you wrote this recent column quoting Rush Limbaugh on the morning after the election. Rush said, I went to bed last night thinking we're outnumbered. I went to bed last night thinking all this discussion we'd had about this election being the election that will tell us whether we or not we've lost the country. I went to bed last night thinking we've lost the country. I don't know how else you would look at this. So you go on in the column to basically state that this is true, that the hard right has lost the country. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Really, what I'm saying is that the culture war has been won, and the left has won the culture war. If you look at the votes on marijuana and gay marriage, there was an abortion vote in Florida. All of these were losses, and basically what's been happening is that the conservative Christian right kind of agenda helped the Republican Party really from the 1970s into the 1990s, became less and less valuable during the 90s, and now in this century, basically the country has flipped and is fundamentally liberal on the social issues, so that those questions are ones that the right just doesn't win on anymore. And I think you can see in a lot of the commentary from Republican consultants that they're fully aware of this problem.
So you go so far as to quote a recent Pew poll that said that a plurality of young people hold a favorable view of socialism and by a tiny margin a negative view of capitalism. So this is quite a turnaround for America, right? This is not what the mainstream media is telling us is what's going on.
Well, socialism remains to be, by the majority of all voters, is not favored by any means. But there is a much more sympathetic view towards socialism among those who are part of what is called the rising American electorate, the electorate that really put Obama into office. Among single women, minorities, young people, and Democratic liberals of all races, those groups which overlap extensively, there's a much more favorable view of socialism and a much more favorable view of an activist federal government in general, and a much more critical view of capitalism than the sort of right coalition holds. And those are the groups that are growing, and they are gaining strength in the electorate, so that over time, and in this last election, I think, they demonstrated majority power. Whether that in off years is another question. The Republicans did well in 2010, and they may well do in 2014. but the long-range trends are clearly favoring the liberal coalition, both economically and culturally. And it's unlikely that that's going to change, and this is going to probably be more and more applicable to presidential elections and, over time, to off-year congressional elections.
So this rising American electorate really is very much in favor of investing in education and infrastructure rather than cutting the social safety net. And yet the Republican House seems absolutely convinced that the only way out of this fiscal cliff situation is by cutting the safety net. How are we going to resolve this situation where you have a House completely in control by the Republican Party and a Senate and an executive branch that feels quite differently?
Well, a number of things. One, the Senate is more ambivalent on these. It includes a number of Democrats who are basically centrist to conservative-ish Democrats. So that it's not like a solid base of support. Secondly, Obama himself is kind of ambivalent on this subject, and he has shown a willingness to cut this social safety net. He certainly was during the bargaining in 2011 over the debt ceiling with John Boehner. So it's not entirely clear whether the views of the rising American electorate are going to be fully represented in the bargaining that we now are undergoing over how to deal with the fiscal cliff and the issues it raises. So in terms of policy, it's kind of a mixed bag at this point. And it's not like we haven't reached the tipping point on the policy end of things, except, I think, on the culture war things. I think it would be very difficult to enact a conservative cultural agenda of any kind at this point.
And yet, Rick Santorum this morning announced that he was thinking of running for president again. Is the Republican Party in total denial?
They clearly, it's going to be a very hard problem for the Republican Party. Going through an adjustment like this is very difficult when you have a party. It's like a corporation that's been building, say, big gas-guzzling cars, and it's got a whole corporate structure of people and employees and managers, all of whom are devoted to the idea of building cars that may no longer be sellable to the consumer. It's very hard to turn around a company like that. To some extent, the Republican Party is in the same situation where it has core constituencies. There's no way they can tell the Christian right, for example, take a walk. The Christian right provides 40% of the vote for Republican presidential candidates. And the economic conservatives who want to cut the social safety net, basically, comprise another significant portion of the Republican-based electorate. So it's the adjustment. How you deal with that is a very difficult process. And I think the Republican Party is really now just beginning to face that.
In your book, The Age of Austerity, which is out now in paperback, you argue that the most recent debates about policy are often trumped by fear. Isn't the very use of the term fiscal cliff an attempt to have fear dominate a recent debate? After all, in January 1 is going to come, and if we do nothing, January 2 will arrive, and there will be no great effect on our economy. It's not a cliff, is it? It's more like a slope. Is that a correct way of thinking about it?
I'm not an economist, so it's hard for me to judge. I don't know whether, for example, if we reach the point where taxes suddenly went up significantly so that middle-class people were paying a whole lot more, and you're taking all of that out of the marketplace, basically. And you have these very substantial $100 billion in cuts, half in domestic, half in military. Again, all money that goes into the marketplace, in a sense, and helps drive the economy you could see the stock market take a real nosedive, for example. And these things, the danger is, I agree with you that what's happened is, what's really happened is that Congress, through various legislative procedures, the way it wrote the sequestration legislation, the way it wrote the Bush tax cuts to attempt to theoretically expire, and the way the payroll tax cut expires on the, I think, the first of the year also. You have three things. They basically created what may be a fiscal cliff, but it is it's a man-made creation. It is not necessarily, it's not an economically created cliff, but it may well be a cliff regardless because of the, you could say, stupidity of the politicians who have created it and now are struggling to deal with it. It's also a cliff that clearly, I think, works to the advantage of conservatives because it does pose this threat of economic deterioration and the possibility of falling into recession again, and kind of forces the hand of government to address these budget-cutting proposals, which are very, it may well be not the right time to be doing that at all. Probably is not.
Well, Senator Patty Murray argues that it's just the opposite, that it plays to the hand of the Democrats, because after all, on January 1, the Bush tax cuts have gone away. So in terms of getting Republicans to have to vote for a tax cut on the wealthiest Americans, I mean, for to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans would not have to happen anymore. Simply then you would raise the vote for to lower taxes on the middle class, and they could vote for that, and they still wouldn't have violated Grover Norquist's pledge. And obviously, if that happened in January or February, nothing really would have changed fiscally because the Treasury has some flexibility as to when they tell people to take higher with withholding taxes and stuff like that. Isn't there a simpler way out of this? Let all the cuts expire?
The problem with that strategy is the tax legislation, according to the Constitution, has to originate in the House. The Senate cannot take this action on its own, although there may be a floating around tax bill that they could use and convert it into that. But barring that, the House has to act first, and the problem is getting the House to act first. If the House could well propose a restoration of all the tax cuts, including on the wealthy, and send that to the Senate. It's true that the Democrats have some bargaining power in this. The only thing I would be wary about on that is Democrats have not shown great bravery on these fights in the past.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I'll tell you why. One basic thing is that a lot of Democrats have a lot of very wealthy constituents. And if you look at Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood contributions, those are from very high bracket taxpayers. And they provide a very substantial sum of money to every member of Congress, including Democrats, running for Congress. Secondly, the practice has become increasingly, the practice of a member of the House or Senate retiring or losing election and then going on to becoming a lobbyist has become more and more prevalent. I think literally more than half of House members now go on and become lobbyists where they make much more money than they did as members of the House. So it's as if the career in the House is not like the culmination of someone's life, but just one step in the process. When you're looking forward to going to work as a lobbyist, your thinking is different than if you were contemplating retiring and going back to your district and becoming a sort of respected figure in the community. You're calculating on who's going to hire you. And I think that colors a lot of what goes on in Congress. The power of the wealthy has increased significantly. And as you get more and more unequal distribution of income, you're basically concentrating more and more power among a group that has a great deal vested in keeping their tax rates low. And if you look at especially Obama's 2008 campaign, I think of his top 10 contributors, about 8 of them were employees of Wall Street banking institutions. That number went down some in this last election because he was not quite so popular with Wall Street. But my point is that it's you have a rising American electorate. It's got a pretty distinct policy agenda or point of view. But the balance of power in Washington does not reflect that at this point.
So,
and that takes a long time to sink in.
Right. So, I mean, you've done a lot of history. I mean, obviously, one could look back to the progressive era at the turn of the 20th century, where Teddy Roosevelt and a coalition of people basically took on J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, the moneyed interests. Do you think there's any hope that in a second Obama term, where he doesn't have to run for election, could be a more reform-oriented term to take on some of these issues you're raising?
Oh, I think it will be a more reform-oriented, but how much more so is another question we have yet to see. And Obama was very willing to compromise, and I think he has been throughout his presidency, even during his first 2 years when he was still pretty popular. He compromised extensively on the composition of the stimulus bill. He compromised extensively on the Dodd-Frank reforms, and he compromised considerably on his health care proposals, all in a vague and unfulfilled hope that he was going to get Republican support. He got zilch on all of those. Now, he may have learned from that. I don't know. I think he clearly is prepared to be tougher, but how much tougher, I just don't know.
What would be a sign for you, for instance, in a new Treasury Secretary or something, that he was willing to have a more reform-oriented agenda? Would it be cabinet appointments, or what would it take?
Well, I think he's got an issue that's coming up probably before he makes many or any possibly new cabinet appointments, which is this fiscal cliff issue, and how does he hang tough on the issue of raising rates on the rich, and is he willing to go to the wall on that like Patty Murray would like them to go? If he is, which he has said he is, then I think that is the real test of that'll be the big first real test, put it that way, of where he's going to go.
I want to remind my audience that I'm speaking with Tom Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University and author of the book, The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Make American Politics, just out in paperback. You mentioned in your Times piece the notion of a kind of welfare for the 1%. You said, in fact, the rising American electorate represents a direct threat to the striking array of government benefits for the affluent that the conservative movement has won over the past 40 years. These include the reduction of the top tax rate, the reduction on dividends, the lowering of estate taxes. Is this a kind of new rhetorical frame that would get libertarians to see that their interests would not necessarily rest with the Republican Party if we kind of framed it as the Republicans have been creating a welfare program for the 1%?
I think that if it can be described as, in effect, a kind of crony capitalism, and a concentration of power, that that could well appear to appeal to libertarians who are opposed to both of those. I mean, there's a libertarian economist at Chicago. I can't pronounce his name correctly, Luis Zingales.
Zanetti, yeah. Right?
But he really is, his main critique is of sort of crony capitalism, of people doing favors and avoiding the market. Insofar as what's been won for the affluent can be described as market distorting, which it is, I think that has a lot of effect. And it also sort of then has broad American appeal, not just to libertarians, but
right.
That was sort of Teddy Roosevelt's basic premise on antitrust legislation.
So this brings us back to this sequestration that you mentioned earlier.
Yep.
It would appear to me that these would be, if it went through, the first real cuts in military spending in over the last 70 years. Wouldn't that be a good thing to have happen, even if it was somewhat of a fiscal drag?
Well, they're accompanied by equal amounts of cuts across the board in social spending that exempts Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and I think food stamps. But there are a lot of other programs there that get cut, too. So it's not just as easy shot. Secondly, I think if you look, the data I've seen recently shows military spending as a percentage of GDP or GNP, whichever you want to use, as sort of going up every time there's sort of a war period, and then going down actually considerably after the Korean War, after the Vietnam War, and right now we're at a high point, and it certainly could go down considerably if it followed the same path as these previous lines have suggested. But again, cutting across the board in the way that the sequestration requires is not a wise way to cut anything. It's like cutting the top 10% of your house off from
right.
Roof down. I mean, it when maybe there are a lot of better ways to reduce your house size.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Tom Edsel.
Thank you.
Again, we've been speaking with Thomas Edsel, professor of journalism at Columbia University and author of the book, The Age of Austerity, How Scarcity Will Remake American Politics. Okay, we're going to take a brief station break and be back with Trevor Potter and talk about Federal Election Commission.
It's the money.